Hey everyone, welcome to the Mass Construction Show with today's guest, Kevin Joyce, counsel at Doherty Law Offices. I'm your host, Joe Kelly, and this is a podcast about all things construction in Massachusetts and beyond. In this episode, we discuss the zoning and Board of Appeals process, including as-of-right projects, dimensional requirements, allowed uses, community meetings, good candidates for appeals, and more. We also managed to shoehorn some politics in there as well, which is always fun. Today's show is brought to you by Central, commercial carpenters and supporters of our conversation. Enjoy the show. Hey, Kevin, welcome to Mass Construction Show.
Thank you, Joe. I'm glad to be here this morning.
Yes, it's exciting to have a former ISD, I guess we'd say employee, but you were the commissioner, so I don't know if that counts as an
employee. Employee, just like everybody else.
Yeah,
employee.
Yeah, your boss is a little bigger than mine, but yeah. So that's exciting. Typically, I don't ask people to lead with what do you do, because we're all in this business and we kind of have a sense, but you're a little unique. So could you tell people, you know,
what would I do? After I left ISD, I went into a law firm, Doherty Law Firm, where I still am today as a of counsel, and my practice is really focused on zoning in Boston, some construction, civil litigation, and real estate development consulting.
Okay, so with Doherty Law, you take on cases of people that one to one.
Zoning cases, most of my practice as it matriculated is corporate, mid-sized developers. I do a lot of zoning law. Zoning work in Boston, and I do work with some smaller developers that we have one and two, three family houses, and that's been their mainstay for years.
Okay, so the corporate stuff would be more large-scale developments.
Article 80 projects is what they refer to in Boston as.
Okay, that's a good place.
Large and small project review is basically a lot of my work consists of large and small project review, and then the zoning work before the Board of Appeal that goes with that.
Okay. Could you explain people Article 80, small project versus large project? Like, there's a 50,000 square foot threshold.
Yeah, there's thresholds. Like, it's a number of units. It's a number of thresholds. Large project to small project review applies to 20,000 or more square feet, and large project review for the bigger projects above that.
Yeah, I think it's 50,000.
I think the limit is 50,000 square feet if you're adding or creating more than that. Okay. It would be subject to large project review.
Okay. So there's kind of three tiers in there. There's, you know, if you're doing a single family home, you're not going to have either of those reviews.
No. Single family homes are exempt.
Yep. And then once you get over 20,000 square feet, you're doing a small project review through the BPDA, right? And that's, how involved is that compared to large project review?
It's less involved, right? Large project review is more intensive because of the nature of the building that you want to build is bigger. It's usually Class A office space or residential space.
Yep.
But Article 80 really came about around 1983, 1984, when the Flynn administration came in. And a lot of people were concerned that there wasn't any predictability in the development process in Boston. So they amended the zoning code to give predictability to the larger projects.
Yep.
And one's large, one's small. Small, you don't have to file as many detailed engineering reports, sustainability reports, green building reports as you do under Article 80. Okay. The Article 80 large project review, that's more for the bigger developers, the Related Bills of the world, the Beacon Company, the Fallon Company. Those folks that are doing those major developments are usually in large project review.
And with that, there's usually, does it tend to be more give and take happening, where the city might look for maybe infrastructure support for the work? Okay, you're going to put this here, now we're going to have this influx of parking, or we're going to need to do ever, so we'd like you to do X,
that,
Y, and Z.
That's correct. And, you know, a lot of it evolves into, some projects lately have been having to do intersections, redoing the intersections, the
new street lights,
new traffic controls. That evolved in the last 4 or 5 years that they started to look for that. Especially with the way the ADA Americans with Disabilities Act plays in.
Yeah.
A lot of the sidewalks don't conform.
Okay. So sidewalks would fall under ADA, where the interior stuff would fall under AAB, the Architectural Access Board?
Architectural, that's correct. Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. All right. So it's a process. There's like the three tiers. There's just a standard zoning review that would happen if you're a homeowner or whatever. And then as the project gets bigger, you have a small project review where there's a little more scrutiny than a basic review, maybe like design review.
Small project review is more design review.
Yeah.
It's more really just about the design of the building and what public benefits can you provide and what's your level of affordability.
Yeah, and why are you seeking relief, right?
It's not likely that you'd ever see a project subject to Article 80 not need zoning relief.
Yes, yes.
Right? So yep, Article 80 is just an approval. It's not an entitlement. It's just that the board's vetted it, the BRA, BPDA has vetted it so that they've put it through a process and they're satisfied that if it gets built, it's going to serve the community well.
Couple of things I would be interested to know is, I guess for people listening, what is an as-of-right project?
An as-of-right project is a project where your use and your dimensions conform to the use and dimension requirements for that district that's set forth in the zoning code.
So there's a set of rules within the zoning code and the building code. You meet all those rules, you submit, and they issue you a permit in... No neighborhood meetings, no design. It's just, you're good. That's as of right. If you do the zoning review and you don't meet those, that's when one of these processes will kick in.
That's correct. Right.
And just out of curiosity, what percentage of projects you think are as of right in the city of Boston?
2%.
I was going to say, it's nowhere near 50 there, right?
No, it's nowhere near 50 because of the zoning code itself. Basically restricts anything. Everything in Boston needs a variance or a conditional use permit, just about. Mm.
It's funny, nationally you're seeing quite a movement to try and change zoning so that more stuff is as of right. You see like states like Oregon where single family is almost not allowed in, I would say, the majority of spaces when you figure per capita. In Oregon, they've almost banned single-family zoning because they want more units, so they're kind of pushing for as-of-right multifamily kind of stuff. So I'd be curious to see if that trend continues.
Well, I think in Boston, Boston is picking up on that. The present administration's commissioned several zoning reports, comprehensive zoning reports, and the sense is that Boston's going back to more of a planning approach to development. With the restructuring of the BPDA, there's going to be more emphasis on planning than there is really on development. So some of the things that are being seen nationally could be brought to Boston in the next several years as they start to redevelop and take a thorough look at the Boston Zoning Code to see where they can manage the growth of the city in such a way that it is not overpowering for anybody. And that and an example of that would be recently when they redid the IDP, inclusionary development policy that requires you to add affordable units to your projects, and they, for the first time, they codified it. The zoning commission adopted an amendment to the zoning code that sets forth the clear criteria that apply to every project that's subject to it. So you don't have to search through these executive
obscure ordinances.
It's going to be right there in the zoning code. It's an amendment to Article 80, and the price, square footage prices are set forth there. Another controversy that's been going on for as long as I've been around it, whether or not you could build your IDP units off-site. That was a big bone of contention, and some people were allowed to do it off-site, others weren't. Well, in the new zoning amendment, it clarifies all that, so it applies to everybody.
Yeah.
If you want to build your units off-site, this is the steps you have to follow.
Yeah, I think it's a very interesting argument, right? I had someone who was making the case for the offsite units, and they said, you know, we can designate five of these units, and I'm just going to pick the Four Seasons, okay? Like, you, but if we're looking for affordable housing for a family here in Boston that wants to send their kids to public schools here, do they really want a unit in the Four Seasons in downtown with like a concierge? It's probably not what they're looking for. And the person's argument was like, yeah, maybe they want that, maybe they don't, but we could put six units in the Four Seasons, or we could build 60 units wood frame somewhere else for the same amount of money, because the square foot cost in a downtown high rise is so much higher from a construction mm-hmm. standpoint. Why not take that $600,000 that will get you, or $6 million that gets you six units in the Four Seasons, or you could build 60 units in Brighton or wherever, podium style or something. So I thought it was a pretty good argument. I'd be curious what the other
side is. Well, see, the thing is now, when that is a good argument. That's a good thing to say. Mm-hmm. But until they passed this amendment, there weren't any rules.
There were no rules.
There wasn't any criteria. There mm-hmm. wasn't any way to plan. There wasn't any standard. There wasn't anything that anybody could look at and say, well, that makes sense mm-hmm. based on what the rules say.
Yeah.
Now they have rules, and I think that makes it easier for everybody to understand, and it keeps everybody informed.
Yeah, and just so consistency.
You can plan your projects out. People can plan out their projects better and know more or less before they get too far down the road what they're going to face.
Yeah. No, I think that's great. And I would think, obviously, I should read that section of the zoning code now, because I'd be curious what it does say.
The zoning commission passed it in October. I don't know. I mean, last month, but I don't know if the mayor has signed it yet. So,
okay. Yeah, that will be interesting to see.
And there was some talk about holding up on it because of the square footage numbers, given the downturn in the economy. But, you know, I believe that you have to look at it sort of globally and say, well, if the economy's down, sometime we can reduce these numbers. And that's something that the administration was open to.
Great. So. Now, I have a question. Sure. I don't think I've met anybody that says, I've always grown up wanting to be a zoning attorney. How did you end up this world?
Yeah, well, it's sort of a long story, but the gist of it is that, you know, I'm a city kid. I'm originally from Dorchester. Mm-hmm. Grew up in Dorchester. I went to the public school system in Boston, and I became a lawyer. And one of my first assignments as an attorney, I was at a criminal law firm with Dan O'Connell and Regina Quinlan, who became a judge. And every year, we represented the adult bookstores in North
Interesting.
End. And every year around...
North End or Chinatown?
In the Combat Zone. Awesome. In Chinatown.
Yep,
and in downtown Boston, what they used to refer to it as the Combat Zone. The zoning classification is Adult Entertainment District, if you will.
Yep.
But anyway, I was like 22 years old or whatever, maybe a little older. And one of my first assignments was to get the licenses renewed every year.
Yep.
And the inspection certificates came from ISD. And in those days, you know, I would spend a lot of my time sitting in old ISD on the 8th floor in City Hall, waiting to one of them to come out and hand me the inspection certificates that expired on, you know, December 30, New Year's Eve at midnight. And I'll tell you, I spent a lot of my New Year's Eves down there waiting until 1 or 2 minutes before 5, and they'd come out and hand them to me.
Yeah.
And that sort of got me into ISD and got me interested in zoning, and it sort of went from there. You know, I was in a criminal practice, but I picked up a zoning thing here or there from just being around, and I built that a little bit.
Yeah. It's funny, like, still to this day, and it's not just Boston and so many city agencies, a lot of it is going and sitting down, whatever department it is, and waiting. But part of that waiting is learning how things operate. I feel like you could sit there and have like a bad attitude and be like, I can't believe we swear on this podcast, by the way. Oh, I can't believe I have to fucking sit here for 3 hours. Why don't they just give me what I need? But, you know, the other approach is, you know, sit there and maybe learn.
I learned more sitting there watching what was going on at that counter back then. It was a lot. I mean, I don't know if people are familiar with how ISD is set up or whatever, mm-hmm. but back then it was just an office in City Hall.
Yep.
It was Bill. It was a counter there, like, and it, you just went in and talked to people. But I learned a lot sitting there. That's how I met, you know, Bill Summers. I was practicing law, and I met him there one day when I was in some little difficulty about some plans examiner that wasn't giving me what I needed so I could move through the process. And after that, I just started to pick up more business, and I stayed there.
Yeah. Who's Bill Summers?
He was a commissioner that came to ISD in the mid-'80s. The okay. Flynn administration installed him, and you know, they had some people down there that got in some trouble with the federal government, and he was sort of brought in to right the ship. And he was the first person that put rules on ISD that people could refer to, you know, before there weren't any rules. Or policies, or procedures, or practices, and he put out written policies and commissioners' bulletins and policy statements to try to give some framework to the way the place should run.
Operate.
So it should inform the public of what the procedures are.
Yeah, yeah, and then everyone.
It's really fair, you know. I was practiced law throughout the Flynn administration, and you know, Regina Quinlan eventually went on the bench, and a couple of years before that, I went to work for the city, and under the Flynn administration, I was the leader of the plan room for a couple of years there as an assistant corporation counsel, and then I went to the law department after that, and Menino came in as mayor, and I was fortunate because I could be part of and watch sort of the whole development in Boston, the way it evolved from the mid-'80s up until, you know, today.
Yeah, I mean, there's so much value in learning those operations, and sometimes it's painful, right? Where like, all right, I've gone down three times, and every time I'm getting kicked back for the same thing. So you learn, like, okay, when I'm going to apply, this is how I want it. And it's like half math, well, 25% math and 75% politics and philosophy.
And philosophy and approach, and even in the, you know, even on the building code side of things, I think sometimes there's a little bit of policy and nuance.
Yeah.
You know, even if it's, you know, you need one of 5 inches of something or other, and how does it fit, or how's that going to make your building more sustainable? Yeah.
And I imagine this is where legal foundation comes in, which is so much of code is interpretive, right? So how do you interpret that, and how can you make your case? And then you learn, like, okay, this just isn't necessarily a yes or no answer. This is a gray area, and what's the right way to approach that gray area?
Especially in the zoning, and that's where sort of the strategy comes in to it all, thinking about what you're going to, how you're going to approach your project, whatever, whether it's a kitchen renovation or it's building a new building. It's just sort of getting a feel for how those regulations are going to impact your thought process.
Yeah. So you went, got a law degree, started practicing some law, got some interface with city from a permitting and licensing issue. You said all this, hey, there's something here. I'm kind of interested in this. You then said, I go to the municipal side.
Regina Quinlan was going to go on the bench in a couple of years. And, you know, did I want to be on my own?
Okay.
Did I really want to be on my own, or did I need a little bit more structure to my life? You know, I was young, I was newly married. I felt I needed a little bit more structure. The opportunity came up at ISD, and they asked me to take it, and I did.
Yeah. So you mentioned you ran the plan room and then some corporate counsel kind of stuff. What was the jump to becoming commissioner of ISD?
To jump to becoming commissioner of ISD, I suppose, after I was in the law department for a little while, and the Flynn administration started an environmental strike team, and that was composed of inspectors from basically every department in the city. Mm-hmm. So I got to know a lot of the inspectors and how they all worked together, and I guess I just morphed into it. I was quietly sitting in my office one day, and I called down on the fifth floor, and Menino said to me, "You're going over to ISD. Jordy just resigned."
Yeah.
And I had no clue.
Yeah.
No clue.
Yeah.
And then that's what happened.
It wasn't like,
you know, you got a choice here.
Yeah, yeah.
You could go over there.
Yep. No, that's funny. And just like, that's timing, right?
Timing.
You were doing the right thing. You were plugging away. Yeah, and
I
then
was in the law department. We were just doing our thing in the law department. I like community stuff, and the strike team helped me. Gave me exposure in the community, and the law stuff was great, and I had a great job.
Yeah.
Until John Eade, who was my predecessor, for whatever reason, I still to this day don't really know why he left, but he just left one day.
Yep.
And then was put on me.
That's great. I like that you just got a tap on the shoulder and said, hey.
So I was sitting in my office. I can remember it. Just sitting there, and they came in and said, the fifth floor is looking for you. And,
That's always a nerve wracking.
What did I do now? Yeah. Or what did I didn't do now?
Yeah.
You know,
that's funny.
You know, meanwhile, we said it at 2 speed, slow and stop.
Yeah, funny. No, I love that. The hope here is I wanted to get the background because some of the stuff I just think is interesting, and I think people kind of like a peek behind the curtain to some degree. And so many people build buildings or design buildings. I even had a structural engineer message me. It was like just to thank me, because he said, you know, I've learned so much about the permitting process and everything that goes to getting a permit. And he says, I'm a structural engineer. I design the drawings, stamp the drawings, I sign an affidavit and stamp it, and then I never know what happens to it. He goes, I had no idea what went into actually getting a permit. So he's like, hey, I just want to tell you, I appreciate the podcast because I learned so much about things that I didn't know. So there's other people as well that are superintendents or project managers, and they get handed a set of drawings and say, hey, go build this building, but have no idea what it took to get to that point or what was involved to get to that point. Even if it was easy, it was still probably a lot of involved steps. So, you know, I wanted that front end just to give people a flavor of what that is. But my ultimate goal in having you here is to kind of help inform people. So I'm thinking we'll probably have a couple of sit downs. Is my thought. And today my hope was to kind of walk through a theoretical, not necessarily project, but, you know, scenario, and kind of let people know what goes into a zoning appeal process.
Appeal, right? Okay.
So let's say someone has a property that they've got a home, and they say, oh, I have a home and there's this extra lot beside me, and they want to develop it, or they're looking at purchasing something and say, hey, it's a single, but it's a pretty big lot. Maybe I could put a 3-family on it. How would they go about determining what they could do with that property?
Well, first thing you do, and this is just a standard thing, mm-hmm. is you get your deed, okay, the deed for your house, the lot beside your house, mm-hmm. and you try to figure out how many square feet you have.
Of property.
So yep. you're looking at it. Let's say we'll go with one thing. Why don't we say we got a 1-family and there's a side lot that goes with it.
Yep.
Okay. So we figure out that I know I own this house because I bought it. I have my closing documents. Mm-hmm. I have my deed. And the first real thing is to get a survey plan or a plot plan. Most people, when you buy houses or land, the banks that you get your mortgage from require the lawyers to give you a plot plan, yep. or to get a plot plan, and you pay for it. Some of the lawyers give it to you, some of them don't. But if you don't have that, you can go to online to assessing in all the cities and towns and get your tax bill. And there's a very, very
there's a very rough plan there. Yeah, not surveying standards, but you'll know
something
about
work
how
with.
Many square feet. Yeah,
and the other thing you want to do is you go onto the registry of deeds for whatever city or town it is. You get your deed, or you read your deed. You try to go to the prior deed until you hit upon a plan. It'll make a reference to a plan at some point. Mm-hmm. You get a copy of that plan. Yep. It's just as a place to start.
Yeah. What I also tell people is a lot of times with your mortgage paperwork, you get a big stack of paperwork. And in there is usually what they'll call a mortgage plot plan.
That's the same thing. Mortgage yep. plot plan. I use the word it's a plan. You know, it's yeah. all different ALTA plans, and that's all sophisticated. But
yeah.
we're talking about a single family house, and a lot beside it, somewhere in all of this, you couldn't come up with
how many square feet you have
and what the general idea of where the bounds yeah. are.
I think it's helpful for people to delineate, though. Like, so the mortgage plot plan, or what you see at the registry of deeds, is not a survey.
It's not a survey plan. No.
Which at some point if you're going to move forward, you'll probably need
a survey plan, or sometimes in the smaller projects, a surveyors call them plot plans still. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yep.
I know at ISD that they require, and the building code requires a plan within 2 years of the date of the application. So,
okay.
And you ultimately will have to have a surveyor draw a plan up.
Okay.
What the surveyor calls that he calls it, and that's going to be sufficient for ISD because he has a license and he knows what he's doing.
Yeah. Right?
So that presupposes. So if he gives you what you need to get to ISD, but before you even engage somebody like that, you try to get an idea of it yourself.
Yeah. So sorry to sidetrack you there.
But no, it's okay.
So the goal there is to find out how many square foot.
How many square feet you have, what the boundary lines of your property are, and then what do you want to do? Do you want to build an addition? Do you want to build a new house? You just draw that on. And then with that little rough plan, you go to the zoning code and you look up your district on the BPDA webpage. If we're in Boston, the zoning code's right there. And you put your address in, and it'll tell you what the zoning district you're in. And then it will give you the use requirements for that zoning district, and it'll give you the dimensional requirements for that zoning district.
And when you say dimensional requirements, you're talking about setbacks?
Setbacks, frontage requirements, street frontage requirements, setbacks from the rear yard, side yard, front yard, setbacks from the street lines and the rear yard lines. You know, you can build on the property line. You have to
in some districts.
Basically, right. You can't build on the property line in some districts, so you have a setback in from that, like 2 feet, 3 feet,
10
whatever.
Feet. Yep.
And so with this little, you know, how I always done it is I've gotten my basic data, wherever I got it from, the assessing or the registry, I put that on a table, and then I put a piece of tracing paper over it and sort of trace out what I want to do. Mm-hmm. And then I do the ruler, I take the scale. And then I figure out how far I am, generally. Mm-hmm. It gives me an idea, and I can say if the side yard requirement is 2 feet, and my little exercise shows me I exceed 2 feet, then I know I have to go to the zoning board on a dimensional requirement.
Okay. So you look at these dimensional requirements. It'll also give you, it might say that that zoning area is like, let's say, 3F5000. So that might mean that you could build up to three units, correct?
Three family, right, provided the lot is 5,000 square feet big.
Yep. So
every area.
Yeah. So you look at the dimensional stuff, you look at what's allowed in that area. Is it a commercial area? Is it a residential area? Is it a single family area, three family area?
It'll tell you. So if you're in a three family zone and you own a two family and you want to add a three family, well, you add one more unit to a three family in a three family zone, you know, on the face of it, that's allowed.
Yep.
Then when you get into the dimensions is where you could get gummed up.
Yep. And then I think the last piece that's kind of just a basic, other than the setbacks and the frontage and the number of units or the type, if you want to put a barbershop there, there'll be a little table where you can say, okay, what's allowed here? Is a barbershop allowed? Yes,
yeah, there's a use table. This is what they call the underlying code. It's Article 80, the underlying code. But in the neighborhoods, they have their own use tables. Every neighborhood has its own use table.
Yep. And then there's also an equation there which would fall under the dimensional bit. Was the floor to area ratio?
FAR. Yeah. That's if you're going to add additional living space.
Yep.
As you're going to trip, only so much living space is allowed. If you exceed that by doing, your proposal exceeds that, then you need a variance for the floor area ratio.
Okay. So it's a very methodical process, right? You go through, do I have the side setback? Yes. Do I have a rear setback? Front setback? Frontage? Am I within the square footage? Is it an allowed use? And if all those are yes.
Yep. Do I have access to the street? That's another question.
Yep. Then it is, would be what you were saying before, is an as of right.
And as of right, right.
And you can get issued a building permit.
You can get issued a building permit.
Yep. Right. Straight away.
You have to go get the surveyor to draw it, and then you have to have the architect.
And you have to submit.
And then you have to get the building code review, and then you get your permit.
Yeah. So, and as you alluded to before, that's maybe 2%.
maybe 2%.
Yeah. The other 98%, so you go through this process and you're like, oh, I want to build a three family and this is a two family area. Are you dead?
No, because you would make your application. If you really wanted to do it, you'd make your application. You'd get what they call a turn down letter or a refusal letter. They use that term interchangeably in Boston. And then you would appeal that to the zoning board. And the turn down letter would list the relief you need. We can't issue the permit because they exceed the rear yard by 3 feet. And then you take that to the Board of Appeal.
Okay, so you still apply. Even though you know you're not going to meet the rule, you still apply.
It always starts with the application. Everywhere in the Commonwealth of Massachusetts, zoning, approvals, and building, it all starts with an application to build something.
Okay. And then you get that refusal letter.
Get the refusal letter.
And then with that letter, you can apply to the Board of Appeals.
Board of Appeal, correct.
What has always stumped me, I spent a little time in zoning while I was there, was the homeowner or developer or whoever would come down and says, this is what I want to build. And they've done their legwork, yep. And they say, it's not allowed because of X and Y. Should I go to the Board of Appeals? Like, and my answer is, I don't know. They're like, what's the likelihood? Am I wasting my time? And there is no black and white answer to that. But what kind of makes something a good candidate? Not a guarantee, but what makes something a good candidate for an appeal? Or like what factors would go into if you were consulting with somebody and I came to you with my project and I said, this is what I want to do. Here's my violations. Would you look at, you know, what neighborhood they're in? Would you look at the local groups that review? Would you look at, oh, hey, it's just a side setback. It's not a problem. What's your relationship with neighbor? Like, what are the things that you take into account when you decide to advise someone whether it's a good idea to go forward with an appeal?
I'll tell you, go back to the adult bookstores, right? If you're going to put an adult bookstore in a single-family zone, forget about it.
Yes.
Yep. Okay? If you've got a street, like a residential street in a three-family zone, and you want to put 40 units there, another thing to think about, okay? Yep. So it's scale and scope. And it's the scale. Does the project sort of fit? I've been at it for so long. I can get a feel for whether or not the project fits, even though I'm not a designer or anything like mm-hmm. that. I can just get a feel. Mm-hmm. So, and I think what I was saying about the planning, I think what we're going to see soon, and they start to advocate for this, is a push to more 3 and 6 family buildings as opposed to these bigger buildings in the neighborhoods, because it keeps it more homogeneous and it's more thoughtful, okay?
Interesting.
So some of the stuff that was approved recently just sort of sticks out.
Yeah, there's 20 units next to a bunch of 3 families.
It's sort of, that's not, it doesn't,
fit the it's not consistent the with the,
especially it's an old city. It just doesn't fit. So anyway, I don't want to digress here, but go back to our one family. Sort of, you want a residential street, you own a one family, you want to build an addition that so you can, you know, have a rental apartment or whatever. Sure, that makes some sense. Mm-hmm. And then the second thing is look at the buildings around it. Is what you're proposing sort of fit with the mm-hmm. architectural
nature
of the building? And then the third thing and the most important thing is what are the people that live, they call them abutters. What do your abutters think? And that's usually the people that live across the street from you, behind you, and alongside of you. Because if you need a variance and you go through this whole process, any one of them can appeal that in court and stop it for a time.
Yes.
Okay? Sure. And the rate used to be 50-50. A Board of Appeal approved a case. When it went to a Superior Court, 50% of the time the board would win, 50% of the time it would lose. Mm-hmm. So it's a legal standard. It's very harsh. It's archaic. And if you basically applied the legal standard to any variance the Board of Appeal grants, probably fail because it can't meet the legal standard. Hmm. So the...
Could you describe that a little more?
The legal standard, to really a true variance, there has to be some peculiar feature to the land that's not common to any other lot in the district. Shallowness... Mm-hmm. Quirkiness in the way that the topography is, some actual physical feature that makes that lot peculiar to every other lot in the neighborhood. And when you look around, you know, most variances are granted to lots that have no particular peculiarity. Nonconformity or mm-hmm. deformity. So it's an old standard. It comes comes from like the 1600s. So, oh, wow. And that's why it's hard. But having said all of that, if we didn't get, if the board didn't grant variances, nothing would get
nothing
done.
Would get, yeah.
So, you, but my caveat being that, you know, make sure that if you're going to spend money and you're going to afford with it, make sure that folks that live next to you
are on board.
Are on board. And I'm not saying that if you get your variance and they appeal it, they'll win. I'm saying it's just something that you consider, especially if you're a homeowner.
Yeah. Well, what's the time that goes into if some if a neighbor did appeal the decision?
2 years.
Yeah, really?
I mean, that's given in the middle range.
Yeah. Not like
2 years.
Starting the whole thing was none of this is black and white, right?
None of it is black and white, and there's court calendars, and the courts are all backed up, as every, we all know.
Yep.
So it's, you're looking at 2 years, and you get a higher lawyer, right? I mean, you go yourself, but if you take it on yourself, I tell people if you do that, you're just torturing yourself because it's going to go on forever.
Yeah.
But
okay. So you, neighborhood impact, character of the neighborhood, does it fit?
Does it? And then there's in Boston and in a lot of other cities and towns, they have design overlay districts. It's not that you need a variance for it, but you just have to go and have your plans approved by the planning board or the BPDA.
Yeah.
So the design. That's all design.
Yeah. So that's not an appeal piece. That's just a layer
check
that
off,
you have to go through.
A check off.
Yeah. Okay. So you use those metrics and you kind of get a sense of whether you think it's...
You get a sense of if, are you comfortable with it? If you're mm-hmm. a homeowner, are you and your significant other comfortable with committing the resources you're going to need to get through the process.
Yeah. What about the next level up, though, the smaller developer? Like, I think their considerations are probably different than a homeowner, right?
Right, because they're in it for profit. You know, mm-hmm. all developers are in it for profit, right? Yep. And nowadays, people that were in, that were known as developers or contractors that were in the business, were more focused on their product, their building product. Mm-hmm. Their architectural stuff, the finishes, actually selling a product that people would want to buy mm-hmm. and want to live in. And in the last 10 years, those developers have started to become owned by REITs and financial people.
Yep.
So it's more about the money than it is about the product. So if you're a developer and you care about your product and you're in the real estate development business or the construction business, you know, you have a little sense of what you know would go in that neighborhood, mm-hmm. especially if that's where you do your work. You're going to know what's going to go and what's going to fit. And, you know both ways. What will the folks in the neighborhood accept? And then sort of you can get a sense of what the BPDA would think about it if it's going to have to go to small project review.
Does the relationship that the developer or the builder has in the neighborhood
immensely
matter?
It matters immensely.
Okay.
And it matters what your track record has been. You know, if the people in the neighborhood know that you're a reliable contractor, that you've done projects in the neighborhood, and that
you follow through on what you say
you're going to do. What you say you're going to do, and you know, it's reputation. It's, you know, a lot of this is word of mouth,
mm-hmm.
right? Yeah. You know, my father used to say, "Have your good name in your word."
Yeah. No. 1,000%. So what? So it seems like once we're moving beyond the single family homeowner and you're looking at now more what I'll call development,
right.
What's a good team look like if you're going
to, well, same go for the homeowner, appeal. Like you're going to take that step. So you want to get yourself someone who's a designer, an architect you can rely upon, a code consultant that you can rely upon, an attorney. And, you know, you should have some a financial component to it. You know, most of them have people in their companies that can do their numbers and decide whether it's bankable or if it's worth doing.
Okay. They look through that. They put their team together. And, you know, even the architect, they probably want to see that person has a reputation.
Oh, it's all reputation. Well, right? If you're serious about it, you wanted to put out a good product, you want a good architect.
Yeah.
Because the design sells.
Yep. Does it get as granular as the architect in Jamaica Plain should be, you know, probably one of these three, and East Boston should be one of those three, or like is
it? Not so much in Boston.
Yeah. Okay.
Not so much. Other cities and towns, sure. Other cities and towns, it matters who the legal counsel is on the developer's head. because a lot of places there's only one or two people that do the zoning work.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's practical. You know, it might not be right, but that's what.
Yeah.
What it is. Okay.
Yeah, it's a reality.
But the bigger the cities are, that's less of a
concern. Less of an issue. Yeah. Okay, that's interesting to know. We do that calculation, both, I guess, what I'll call the political calculation and the, and by political, I mean you're talking to your neighbors.
Community engagement.
Thank you.
How's that? How's that going to work?
That's community better. Engagement. That's why you're an attorney and I'm a consultant.
That's a communications word.
Yeah.
Right? Community engagement.
Yep. So you gauge the community, you gauge the level of nonconformity you have, and you say, okay, I'm not that outside from what I'm looking for from a zoning perspective. I'm not looking to put, you know, I'm not looking to do a zero lot line with a 20-foot setback, right? So I'm not crazy on that front. The community seems to be on board. I want to push forward. I go, as you said, I apply, I get my refusal letter. Then what?
Then you apply to the Board of Appeal, and you get your Board of Appeal docket number. And then the first step is an abutters meeting in the community. The Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services will set that up for you, and they'll have a meeting, and they've been doing them, or they're still doing them online or on Zoom, and you explain your project to your neighbors and get what kind of feedback you get. And that's going to, you know, give you an idea of how you're going to fare. And the other thing is, if it's a small project review, you'd file a contemporaneously or concurrently with your appeal. You'd file, actually concurrently with filing your building permit in the first place, you'd file a booklet with the BPDA, an application with the BPDA.
Okay, so I take that letter, I apply to the Board of Appeals, and then I go to the neighborhood
meeting. They call it a MONS meeting, M-O-N-S, Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services.
Yep.
That's used interchangeably with the word abutters meeting. And that's just the first step in the process. You have to do that before you'll get scheduled to a Board of Appeal hearing.
But not to confuse people, the abutters meeting is not necessarily just truly abutters.
It's they call it abutters meeting when it's within 300 feet. What they'll do is here's your building, they will draw a circle 300 feet out. Mm-hmm. And then that's the people that they'll tell you, you need to flyer. You put flyers on their doorsteps about the meeting.
Notify them about the meeting.
Right.
But if I'm 400 feet away, but I'm within that neighborhood, I can show up and say, no, I don't want a...
Sure. Yeah, but that's... You figure out who those people are. I mean, if they're not touching or concerning your land, if they're not what they call an immediate abutter, that's somebody that touches your property or lives across the street from you, they have less what they call standing in a court. So those people can't really hold you up. It's just the immediate abutters that have the standing.
But won't that group, that meeting, there's typically like a little board that they have, don't they?
Oh, in some neighborhoods, well, no. That depends on the size of the project. If we're the one family and we want to add a unit, we just go to a abutters meeting that the mayor's office runs, okay? Mm-hmm. Bigger projects, the BPDA, when you get into the... small or large project review, they recommend that you go to the community organization if there is one in the district, the neighborhood council. Neighborhood council, the Charlestown neighborhood council,
one here in West Roxbury,
Roxbury neighborhood council, and there's in the zoning code, there's a segment on the neighborhood councils have the ability. I just can't remember it off the top of my head to review these things, and then they can issue. And issue a letter of support or non-opposition to whatever they do, but that's all weighed.
Right.
Right? That's all weighed.
Yeah, that's not a definitive yes or no. That's just, hey, I want to build this podium building, 12 units in this area. I went to the neighborhood council. They're giving me a letter of support. That letter of support goes to the Board of Appeals, who have the ultimate
say. That's right.
No. Okay.
And a letter of, similarly, a letter of opposition would go to the board. But that's what the board is. The board's basically the trier of fact, the adjudicator.
Yeah. Okay. So if it's the single family stuff, you're just going to go to that mayor's office of neighborhood, would you call it MODS?
MODS, Mayor's Office of Neighborhood Services.
Yep.
And that's synonymous. These are all like terms of art. in Boston. That's synonymous with a butters meeting.
Okay. So you do that little butters meeting. Yep. Your new kitchen addition is approved.
The butters say everybody on the call at the meeting says, oh, this is a great project. Okay. The next thing that would happen in that case about the kitchen or the one family house is it's going to go from there. It'll get scheduled for hearing with the Board of Appeal. The small projects, the homeowner projects, go to what they call the advisory board, which is a subset of the Board of Appeal. Those meetings are held by the board. It's on Zoom, but it's not the full board.
Okay.
You get there quicker. So you're not waiting behind the Prudential Center for variance.
Got it.
They cull all the homeowner projects, the one, two, and three families. They're culled out of the big board process and they're put on the advisory board agenda. It goes a lot faster.
Okay. And that decision is final, though.
Yeah. Well, if the advisory board approves it, it would go on the agenda for the main board at the next main board hearing.
And that's more perfunctory.
It just provides a rubber stamp.
Yeah.
Because a lot of the times the advisory board is chaired by the chairman of the main board.
Okay.
So it's in this small, the homeowners. So we're not going to
kill them.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. That's
very good. There's no mindset here to kill homeowners. It's just informing them enough about the process so they can get through it with as most efficiently and quickly
as
possible.
Yep. Development. A little different.
Well, that's a little different because it has a bigger impact. It impacts a wider range of people and infrastructure and things like that. Yeah.
Now, what about like neighborhood liaisons for those bigger projects? Like, are they a good resource to reach out to somewhere in this process?
The mayor's office liaisons?
Yeah.
Yeah, sure. That's their job. They're supposed to explain, inform, tell people what the process is and what steps they think they need to.
Yeah. Can they be like a good resource to kind of take the temperature of things or?
Everyone's human, right?
Yeah.
So as a practical matter, sure. Mm-hmm. They could say to you, look, what are you doing this for? Whatever.
Yeah.
But they can't get themselves in a position of making the city liable for anything either.
Right.
Right. So they, think about what you're doing, but. I can't tell you yes, I can't tell you no. I can tell you think about what you're doing.
Yeah. It's a data point.
That's what I used to do. Yeah. Right? I can't tell you no, I can't tell you yes. I can tell you think about what you're doing and you have every right to go forward.
Yeah. Okay. Data point,
right?
Yep.
You know, it's information.
Yeah. So you go through that process, let's say it's a bigger one, you do the neighborhood, you get a yay, nay, or neutral, the board makes a decision, yes.
Yes, then you write a decision, submit it to the board. The next hearing after that, usually the board will sign it, and that goes back into the file at ISD. By law,
then you get a permit and you start building.
No, you gotta wait. This is by law. Because of the, like we talked about, the appeal in the Superior Court, there's a 20-day period. If the appeal's not filed within 20 days, then ISD will process your building permit.
Also, part of that, though, is they still have to do their building code review.
They still have to do their building code review, but, you know, you the applicant, use that 20 days to get all your stuff in
together.
There. So everything is there, and hopefully they can, you know, the smaller projects, I think they make a good faith effort to get them out of there.
Yep.
You know, so they're not, you know, you just get them out of there because the people, the taxpayers, the homeowners, move it along.
Yep.
There's much less technical details that go into a one unit addition than into the Prudential Center.
Yeah.
And that's where you come in. And the bigger projects, you know what goes on.
Yep. Okay. So, but at that point, I'm only bringing it up because you still could be looking at a 30 day review.
You probably, when the board signs your decision, you're probably looking at 45 days.
You get the 20-day waiting period, get all your stuff together, and then another 30 at ISD.
Another 30 or so at ISD. And, you know, there are ways, if you apply, they can maybe get you started on a short form or something. But that's more technical. That's more building code stuff.
Yep.
They can let you start, do some demo, whatever you're doing. You know, you can maybe get lesser permits to get you going until the other one pops out.
So realistically, what do you think this is? start to finish ballpark for, let's say, a podium building, from concept to legwork, appeals?
I'm working on one right now. I filed the application in November.
Of this year?
November 17th, I filed the application. Mm-hmm. They have 30 days to issue the turndown letter, which we're coming up on that now. Mm-hmm. And I told my clients to expect that they could be through the process probably mid-April.
8 months?
Yeah.
November, December. Six, seven.
And part of it's controlled by the notice requirements.
Yeah.
So when they, you know, you might have your butters meeting on a given day. Well, you miss the notice for that month's hearing. You got to wait the 30 days to the next hearing.
Yeah. Or you didn't submit the right documents and you got a more info letter and
something like that. Right. But on this one, I figured I'd be out of the ISD with my turndown letter by the end of the month. I'd file the appeal, hopefully by the end of the year. Mid-January, I'd have the abutters meeting, which would put you on the February board, which would get you to March and April.
And then another month to get it issued.
Yeah.
The permit itself.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's how it is. You can't, and it's going pretty fast. That's everybody.
Yeah, that's quick.
That's with no issues. That's with having, and part of that goes to filing a complete application in the first place. Give them everything they ask for.
You know, that's a whole other episode, Kevin.
Okay. All right.
Yeah. I'm joking with that statement, but yes, that's getting the right documentation is so much of this.
Big part of it.
Yeah. Let's say the Board of Appeals says no.
Well, if the Board of Appeals says no, the applicant has the right to appeal that decision to the Superior Court. And in Superior Court, it's a new trial. So you have to put your case on and let it up to decide, let the judge decide.
Have you ever seen those?
Yes, I represented people in court on those, on both sides of the V.
Yeah. Have you won? Have you seen them win?
Have I? A couple of them, they've prevailed because of facts and things that were quirky about it.
Okay.
And in the cases that... when I represented the city, I believe we the law department prevailed twice and lost once, something like that. That's years ago though.
Yeah, wouldn't the history of the city's prior decisions have a? Here's where I think So like, let's say you've just issued 6 unit buildings. 3 of them over here, and now I'm building one, and you refuse mine. Is that a thing?
That doesn't work because before the court is already the question of the variance as it pertains to that particular property. The city did, other sites, they're all different. There's not a common denominator tied to that particular land. The case is all about that one piece of land.
Okay, so
whatever the lot is, that's what the case is about.
But isn't there, like, I know sometimes when it's building code stuff, they want to see that the city is consistent with their application of the.
But that's the building, that's a building code board, right?
And then even when it has gone to court, this is a long time ago, I didn't know we were going to be onto this, but I've seen cases where the judge was like, no, the city is being inconsistent in their application of this interpretation. So if your interpretation has been this and this on these ones, and now it's X and X on these two, and then when on this one your interpretation is Y, we understand it's gray. You can pick X or you can pick Y, but you can't pick X here and Y there.
That's because the building code is more, and I don't want to say strict, is more...
technical.
But more technical and more geared to public safety. That it's so the court can look at that, and it's a different type of appeal. See, an appeal on a building code case, that's a judicial appeal based on the record. So it could come in that way. Mm-hmm. Whereas a zoning appeal is not a judicial appeal under 30A. It's a trial de novo. It's like having the trial all over again.
Okay.
All right, so in a zoning appeal, you go before the judge, it's like having the trial all over again.
Okay, except it's a judge and not a Board of Appeals.
Yeah, it's a judge and not a Board of Appeals. On a building code case, all that goes before the judge is the record.
Okay.
We don't based on these facts, what this record shows the judge, the facts, just like the appeals court.
Yep.
Based on these facts, did this board exceed it, or did the fire chief or whatever exceed his authority or not follow his own process?
Yeah.
That's a different type of thing.
Those
are process cases.
Yeah.
Whereas the zoning appeals are, a gunfight from the beginning. It's just the same.
Interesting. So understanding that, like, being community engagement is such a big part of this. I'll say this isn't your first rodeo, right?
No.
I won't say anything more than that. No. You were talking about Mayor Flynn, right? So you've seen quite a few administrations. Did your approach have to change as administrations change? Like how does your job evolve as the mayors change?
Well,
administrations
change. There's different priorities, shall I say? Mm-hmm. Okay, and as the administration comes in, when I was first started practicing law, I was a transition between Kevin White and Ray Flynn. Okay, yep. And it was that transition, and then there was the transition between Ray Flynn and Menino. And then, I was practicing private law again when it was between Menino and Walsh. And, just generally from when it transitioned from Kevin White to Ray Flynn to Menino, it was more of a approach that it was managed growth, planned growth, as if they, and it was between the downtown under Ray Flynn was more, Kevin White was more focused on the downtown, and that probably came from his predecessors, the Hines administration that started all this in the 40s. That's where the BRA came from.
Yeah.
So it was more planned growth, and the planning was more visible in it. And then in the last administration, it was more about the development and the planning.
Okay.
And so I think that as it evolved, when it got to the middle, Flynn and Menino, it became a little bit more balanced between the downtown
and
the neighborhoods. And Flynn people first came in, there was a big outcry that the neighborhoods weren't being included in the process. That's why, like that zoning code amendment I referred to about the neighborhood councils being included in the zoning code. Mm. That was the Flynn administration priority was community participation.
Okay.
And so that evolved along that line. And then Menino came in. He continued the community participation, and both of them continued this idea of balanced growth. Even though we need more affordable housing, even though we know we need it, we just can't cram it everywhere.
Yep.
We got to be thoughtful about it. And they, in my mind, took more of a thoughtful approach, but that's my own personal opinion. And I think we're going back to the thoughtful side of things.
Yeah. How does it change the way you need to operate?
You have to follow the new policies. You have to adapt the thinking of the department, whether it was the law department or whether it was the ISD department, to bring it more in line with the thinking of the sitting administration.
So where the priorities are for that administration, you want to try to incorporate that as best you can
in your programs. And that's all your budget. All our priorities are all determined by budgets. Hmm. So what in all of ISD is a pretty good example, because ISD has so many departments. It's just not the building department. It's the housing department. It's the health departments. It's waste and measures. Yep. It's environmental sanitation. Hmm. So when you sat down to do your budget, you could tell what their priorities were, because they were going to give you X number of dollars for
this department.
Health is going to get $50,000, and I'm just making this up. Yeah. Environmental sanitation is going to get $25,000. Well, obviously, the
health is the priority.
Right, and building inspected, building department's going to get three new inspectors, and everybody else is there's some word for it, level headcount or whatever they used to call it.
Yeah.
But you could tell by the priorities the administration are all established by the budget and the functions they're funding, mm-hmm. and then where they put their priorities. Like, what do you want to do? You want to inform people and educate them about the way the place works. Mm. Cut down on red tape. Yeah. Things like that.
You, in the very beginning, had mentioned that the current administration is taking a more planning approach.
In my view.
No. This is just your opinion. These are your opinions, right? Like, what is that? I legitimately don't, like, what does that mean?
Well, I think what I see them doing.
Forgive me, and I'll maybe ask it a little better. Meaning, like, taking a true, like, urban planning approach?
Yes.
Where they're looking at, like, okay, what's the end result of what we want this to look like?
Correct.
Like,
that's correct. And if you've seen what they've done, and they've awarded contracts to consultants to write reports along those lines. And the things they've passed or things that have gone through the Zoning Commission recently are based on reports from outside consultants to sort of guide the thought of the policymaker.
So the neighborhoods almost, you and I are just speculating spitballing here. So I'm not saying you're saying that this is what they're saying. But an analogy I might make is you have institutions and they do the institutional master plan.
Yes.
So everybody looks at it and says, okay, here's what the plan is for Northeastern or for Brigham and Women's Hospital. These are the new buildings we want to build. This is the new park we want to put in. And they look at it and say, this is our plan for the next 30 years, 40 years, 50, whatever it is, right? And then there's like a thought process about where it's all going. Are you starting to see like some of like more of that kind of thought?
Yeah, because what I'm seeing is the city's getting, you know, they're spending the money on urban planning reports, and those reports combined with the community outreach the BRA is doing with these planning sessions about the changes to the zoning code, they're sort of starting to inform themselves.
Okay.
Right. So we're getting the input from the community. You know, this is what the plan is. This is what the urban planners are thinking. What do you folks in the community think? Yeah. And as a result of that outreach and those community meetings, you see them in the, advertised all the time about plan this and plan that. Mm-hmm. The ones, squares and streets they've got going now. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a combination. That's a combination of listening to what the folks in the neighborhood want and what, you know, an urban planner might think. Mm-hmm. And both of those conversations inform each other so that everybody sort of starts to
move in one direction.
Consensus about one way to go or another way to go. Hmm. And I think that's better for everybody, myself.
Yeah.
What do I know?
The other interesting tidbit that you alluded to is you kind of felt like it seemed to be more interested in, okay, we want 100 more units. Rather than putting two 50-unit buildings in here, let's do 33 to 6 families or 2 to 6 families sprinkled throughout. And that's an interesting discussion or concept because there's a group called Strong Towns that people who listen have heard me talk about them a lot. And even I had this gentleman, developer from Providence on, and he talked a lot about it. The idea of incremental development or incremental growth, meaning that the most successful cities and what we kind of places that we historically enjoy, like we all know, like the European cities we go to or certain downtowns we go to and we're like, wow, we love the way this feels. Those happen by incremental development. Like someone had a building and wanted to put a cafe next to the thing. So it got attached on and like growth came by just incrementally adding to what might've started as a downtown that was all one level shops. But then infill lots happened and then they added an addition to this and they put a cafe on the first floor of that. And, you know, there's a lot of people that would say that's the right way to grow versus saying, oh, we want to grow by having, you know, some REIT come in here and slam in a planned development that nobody wants. Right.
Right.
So I, for one, will be interested to see if that is the way it goes.
I sort of have a sense that that's going back, or I don't want to say go back, but that was how it was.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It was a blurb. Now it seems to be falling back that way. But.
Yeah. Yeah. And but at that time, you also had either no zoning code or different zoning code.
Different zoning codes.
There wasn't so many restrictions built in. I mean, there are so many restrictions in the Boston zoning. It's like, it's so challenging.
I agree with you.
It's like,
I agree with you.
Yeah.
I agree with you. And I think, you know, they've done some, they've worked within the footprint of the zoning code they have to try to make things go easier for small projects.
Yeah.
And I think we're at the point where the zoning code itself really needs a revamp. And they've got a consultant. I don't know if the study's done yet, but they're working on a study for a, or it might have came out already. I don't know about it, to revamp the zoning code. Suggestions. And that all is going to have to go through the planning process.
Okay. All right, Kevin, this was fantastic. For people that are listening, the hope here is to bring Kevin in to talk about some more subjects. Kevin and I, when we first chatted, and, you know, I'm going to speak for him here, but Kevin felt like he's had so many years of doing this, and it was almost kind of a time to, like, okay, let me just kind of give back about, you know, and help educate people. And as people that listen know that really that's what I want this show to be, to help make everybody better at what they do. So we're going to bring Kevin back to talk about additional topics, one of them about purchasing land. But if there are other topics that you're interested as a listener, please shoot me a message, and I think Kevin will be willing to sit down and hopefully answer those questions.
Absolutely.
So, all right. Appreciate it, Kevin. All right. Thanks. Bye. Bye-bye.